the challenges are huge, but also you can practice connecting with others and building relationships and trust anywhere that there is more than one person.
Hello and welcome to In Trust. My name is Rick Kitagawa.
And my name is Lisa Lombard. And thanks for joining us for our show about the most valuable asset today, trust.
Today, we are so excited to welcome Catherine Evans, who is the president of Rooted Strategy, a consultancy which she founded to provide support and encouragement to organizations that seek to improve the lives of people. Catherine's track record is both diverse and expansive, ranging from neighborhood organizing to regional planning initiatives to national social change networks. Her strengths are building resilient teams and networks, telling powerful stories, and holding space for big shifts to happen in complex systems. Based in Kansas City, Catherine maintains a critical analysis of the nonprofit and philanthropic ecosystem because she desires to creatively destroy oppressive systems and practices that dominate the sector and to facilitate the transition towards inclusive spaces where power is generated to liberate people. So excited to have you on the show, Catherine, but before we dive in, a quick word from our sponsors.
The future is now here, both in the metaphysical sense as well as the book sense. Our new book, The Future is Trust, Embracing the Era of Trust-Centered Leadership, is now available in both ebook and paperback formats on Amazon and most places where books are sold online. So go get your copy. We are so excited to bring this reimagination of what a leadership book can be. And whether you prefer a clean, text-centric ebook or the full-color photo print edition, we've been intentional in cutting out the fluff to bring you a book full of actionable and practical insights that will help you build the trust needed to help your organization thrive and build a resilient culture. If you haven't got your copy yet, visit thefutureistrust.com to pick one up today. And if you have got your copy, we would love an honest review on Amazon. Trust is better together. So we hope you'll join us in our quest to make the world a more trustworthy and trusted place and get your copy of The Future is Trust.
Catherine, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
We're really excited for this conversation, Catherine. And for those who are just meeting you for the first time, could you share a little bit more about who you are and what you do?
Sure. So my name is Catherine. I was born in Tennessee, which is the home of my ancestors. I like to say that my ancestral home is the Mississippi Delta region, and I identify very strongly with that region for a lot of reasons, but primarily because I'm a Black woman and Black women in this country have a very deep and historic tie to the South. A lot of our strength and resilience was formed in that place. And so I draw a lot of my sense of self and my identity from that region. And currently I live in Kansas City, Missouri, which is my chosen home and where I live with my partner and my daughter. In terms of what I do, there's many different ways that I could describe it. I've been described by a colleague as a dancer with a clipboard. I've been described by one of my coaching clients as a transformation artist, which I kind of like the sound of it, even though it sounds a little bit like a magician or something. But the way that I like to describe myself and what I consider myself is I'm a guide for people who are seeking to heal themselves and to heal the systems that they're a part of. And I consider myself an architect of a more inclusive future. And I do that work primarily through my consulting practice, which has focused on transforming philanthropic systems, and helping philanthropic professionals to be much more wise and thoughtful about how they approach all of their practices, especially grant making and relationships with community. And I also do my work through networks, which we can talk a lot more about later, but networks are connections that are either tight or loose between people in a given place and time. And my goal with networks is to help the people who are part of those networks to connect, learn, and grow together in intentional ways for the impact that they want to see in the world. So that's how I would probably describe what I do.
That's awesome. I'm super excited about digging into a few of these different areas of expertise that you're bringing and the change that you're making. And I feel like you are, in sort of the short time that I've gotten to know you, Catherine, I feel like you're very intentional about the work that you do, the communities you seek to serve, and how you go about telling your story about the change that you're making. And I am just very interested in how have you kind of narrowed down your focus? Because I feel like it's very easy to look at nonprofits as a whole or communities as this larger kind of ecosystem, but I've found you to be very surgical almost in how you niche down and focus on a very specific set of people or communities or organizations. And I would love to kind of just hear how you think about or how that process has been for you of finding the people who you're really here to serve.
Thank you for that question. I would say that when I first started practicing my work independently, so in other words, not working as an employee for a nonprofit or a philanthropy, I did not have the level of clarity that I have now. I was much more of the mind that I have these skills and I have these experiences that could serve a broad range of missions and types of organizations and types of leaders. I was always really focused on working in smaller systems because I find often that smaller systems are systems that are newer in terms of the time that they've been alive, are much more willing to be nimble and adaptable and experimental, which are qualities that I seek to embody myself and therefore really like to bring into my work. So that clarity has always been there, but I was still, you know, taking kind of all kinds of work that was coming my way. And my business is actually fairly young. I have been in business and Rooted Strategy has been running since the fall of 2019. And so, you know, about 6 months after I launched, I was in a position where I had a full book of work, and it happened much more quickly than I expected. And I remember feeling really excited that, wow, like I just launched this business and, you know, I have such a great network and such great connections that I'm already have enough work to sustain me. And that's great. But there was also a small part of me that was kind of, I don't know, felt a little bit disconnected from some of the work that I was doing. And I wouldn't come to understand why that was until a little bit later. But around the time that I started to get really busy with my work was also the time that COVID-19 shut down everything and really changed everything in my life. I mentioned earlier that I have a daughter and she's turning 5 next week. And so when March 2020 came, and she was no longer able to go to her day school that she went to while me and my partner worked, all of a sudden we are having to really rethink time and energy and how we spend those things. And I started to realize that, you know, if I only have so much time in a day to do my work, to practice what I'm here to do, because I also have to be attentive to the needs of my child and my own well-being as well, then I better make sure that the things I'm working on are things that I really care about and that are really important to me, because I don't have a whole lot of extra time to play with. And so I just got a lot more clear about what was important. And then in early summer of 2020, after the murder of George Floyd, I started getting all kinds of calls from all kinds of institutions and leaders who were really just feeling disoriented and having a hard time coping with all the change that was happening, not just with COVID, but also with this really public racial reckoning that the entire country has been experiencing. And so at that time, it became even more critical that I, you know, could hear about a problem that a leader or an organization was having, and I could hear their requests for my time, and then be really discerning about, is this really how I want to spend my precious time? Is this really where I want to put my precious energy? Because just like everyone else in every other organization and leader that I was talking to, I was also experiencing my own sort of deep, some might say spiritual, psychological upheaval and reordering, re-sense making of the world at this time. And so I had to be able to make decisions that would enable me to preserve my own well-being so that I could really give myself to the well-being of others, other people, other systems. So I think that, you know, in moments of crisis, there are often opportunities for clarity. And that's kind of how I've seen the past couple of years, is an ongoing process of me getting more and more clear about what's really important to me and what kind of impact I want to have on the world and how I want to do that through my work.
I am in awe of the thoughtfulness and care in that process for yourself, for your family, for those you're seeking to serve, and slowing down, because I think that could be hard to do in our very busy world. And looking at it from a place of you showing up in a way where you can do so in a sustainable manner and make an impact, because I would suspect the work that you do involves a lot of complexity, a lot of different people, and some issues that involve a lot of emotional labor and a lot of labor that goes with it as well. And as you were describing some of this, I couldn't help but reflect on the name of your consultancy, Rooted Strategy. And I'd love to know what the meaning is of that for you, and if the meaning of that has shifted for you over the pandemic as well.
Yeah, I am so proud of Rooted Strategy. And I really do think that the name reflects my deepest held values around connection, around groundedness, purpose. When I first started brainstorming and thinking about, you know, going out on my own and starting my own business, I knew that it would be really important that I came up with a name that really represented who I am. Because, you know, Rooted Strategy, it's never been, and I don't think it ever will be, a brand that is like a vanity brand, right? This is not a practice that is to showcase Catherine. I have some incredible partners and collaborators that I work with in this organization who have shaped me and sharpened me. But I do want the work to always reflect the values that I have. And what do I value? I value understanding, or at least seeking to understand, why you are here. I value the process of healing and growing that is often complex, as you said, and can be extremely challenging, but is a necessary condition for growth. And when I think about those values, and when I think about how to apply those values in my daily life and in my practice, and how I coach and advise others to apply those values, the image that keeps coming up for me is roots underneath the ground. There's a lot of wisdom for us in nature. And one thing that I have learned about root systems is that they're much deeper and much more complex than we could ever see from what's, you know, based on what we see above the ground. And the health of the tree or the plant, whatever natural resource is in the ground, the health of that plant is really contingent on the health of the roots. And so anything that's going to happen above ground, any bearing of fruit, any strengthening of the trunk or the stem, is very much dependent on what's beneath. And I've also learned that root systems in complex natural ecosystems actually communicate with each other. Now, I put communicate in quotes because it's not like, you know, like you might picture like Lord of the Rings, like the talking trees. Not that kind of communication.
That would be cool though.
It would be. And it's really, yeah, really, really kind of funny to think about. But there are these really organic and naturally occurring connections between root systems that give signals so that these organisms can give signals to one another about what's going on above ground, right? About the health of the ecosystem and about how much space we're all taking up so that we can be in a symbiotic relationship rather than in a competitive relationship. The more I learned about that, the more I started to sort of think about how do I bring these values and this thinking into my business, the more I just sort of stuck with a rooted strategy is one that acknowledges that there is just as much or more going on beneath the surface of a system or a person as there is on top or out in the world externally. A rooted strategy is one that acknowledges who we are and why we're here and why we're doing the work that we're doing right now and why are we the right people to be doing it. It acknowledges who we love and who we care about. And it also acknowledges what we still need to learn in order to be successful. And so that's the inspiration behind Rooted Strategy. And I'm finding it more and more relevant. I mean, honestly, the longer that I practice this work, the more relevant that theory of change that undergirds Rooted Strategy actually becomes.
So Lisa knows I love two things, and both of those showed up in your response, Catherine. One, plant biology, and two, extended metaphors for the ways that humans interact with one another. And so I was just like, yes, I love this answer.
I'm speaking your language.
Yeah, totally speaking my language.
It's Rick's love language.
Yeah, plants. I think that is really interesting, incredibly thoughtful. And a word that you've kind of mentioned a few times, or maybe a theme I'll say, is the idea of community, network, collaboration, symbiosis. And something that's really kind of struck me about things that you've mentioned on your website is really about doing the work that we've talked about in terms of, I would say, building bridges, helping organizations collaborate across various lines, such as, you know, cultural, racial, religious, economic differences, things like that. And I think a lot of people, when you turn on the TV or open Twitter or whatever, you see how hyper polarized everyone seems to be. And it seems like crossing the divides or the gaps, let alone collaborating, seems like something that doesn't exist today. And I would love to maybe have your thoughts just on how you think about making those bridges happen when it can often feel like those gaps are just too big to cross.
I'm a big proponent of making the big small. There's a concept in network ecology called fractals. And fractal patterns are essentially patterns that are replicable at scale, at any scale. And so the way that I have learned to practice in these complex systems with people who embody all types of difference, right, is, I mean, it sounds very basic, but it's really through intentional commitment to relationship and to trust. And it's a simple solution, and also it's not, because on one hand you could say, you know, it's just as easy as getting to know someone and understanding what motivates them and sharing your story with them and allowing yourself to be open to a connection with them. It's a lot easier to say that than to actually do it for so many reasons, right? I mean, we have practical reasons like constraints on time and energy, right? Like, how many more people do I really want to be close to? Do I really want to try to get to know? There's also the constraints that have come with the pandemic, right? Not being able to be in close proximity to others. And it's a real tragedy, actually, because we're a country that's already very disconnected socially. And so the pandemic sort of heightened that. Then you also have these sort of systemic challenges, which include segregation, residential segregation, right? So we don't have people with differences living in the same place. We have challenges like racism, which prevents people from being open to relationships with those that look different than them or who have a different cultural expression. So the challenges are huge, but also you can practice connecting with others and building relationships and trust anywhere that there is more than one person. So a great case study that I love to share is my own neighborhood in Kansas City. And I have to just put a disclaimer out that this is not your typical neighborhood. Like, we are, we've all acknowledged that we're very unique in a lot of ways, but we moved into our house 6 years ago. And our neighborhood is filled is houses with front porches, which is one of the things that we really liked about the house. And the front porch is a great place for connection because you can stand on the front porch and you can see everything that's going on in the neighborhood. You can start to notice the patterns, like, you know, this neighbor up the street walks his dog in the morning and then in the evening. You know, we noticed that the mom who stays at home with her kids, you know, every day around noon, she sends her kids outside so that they can play. So you start to notice these things. And when you notice the patterns that are happening in your system and you start to make interpretations about what you're noticing, right? So next time that mom comes out at noon, I'll be outside so I can go over and introduce myself to her and introduce my daughter to her kids, right? So you start to notice how you can actually intervene in these systems and shape the pattern as a result of your interventions. And then the front porch has also been really valuable because over time, it's a place where I've been able to get to know my neighbors really well. So going from just waving across the street to, hey, come on over, sit down, have a cup of coffee with me. Let's get to know each other a little more. These relationships have evolved from simple hellos to, right before the pandemic started, we had a regular pattern of the six houses on our block that have kids. We had dinner together once a week. And we called it neighbor dinner. And one family would open up their home and we'd all bring over the food that we were going to eat anyway, but we did it in community and our kids could play together and we could get to know each other. And that stopped when the pandemic started. But because of the strength of those relationships that we had really made an intentional commitment to forming, our resilience during the pandemic was remarkable. And some examples that I can give you were, you know, all of our kids couldn't go to school anymore. So we took turns homeschooling each other's children. When neighbors lost their jobs, we gathered together and paid for groceries. We had two babies born in 2020. So we took diapers and we took gifts. After the murder of George Floyd, we live in a part of the city where the protests were happening on almost a nightly basis. So there was a lot of anxiety. There was a lot of tension in the air. And we did wellness checks on each other, kept up, you know, a group text that we sent encouraging notes and gathered each other together to walk down the protests as a block. There was one day that I recall really clearly where we all wanted to go to a protest, but we couldn't leave our kids because there was no one to watch the kids. So we took our kids with us and we all had roles. So a couple of us were, our job was to make sure the kids had snacks and had a blanket and a place to sit and that they felt comfortable and reassured that they were safe. And another person had the role of sort of walking around the perimeter and keeping an eye out for anything that might be disruptive to us. So we all played really critical roles for each other and became sort of a lifeline. And I think that that's what's so inspiring to me about the simple act of connecting to another person is that the possibilities are extremely powerful. And given that we are in a time, a remarkable time of change and transition and uncertainty, and there are too many crises to count. So how do we build networks of relationships that are resilient enough and strong enough and reliable enough to help us respond to the crises that we're experiencing and that we will experience in the future? And so that's kind of where I sit on it. I mean, there's some huge challenges that we have. And yeah, it does feel really insurmountable sometimes, but I just don't know if there's anything more resilient than a group of people who know each other and care about each other and want one another to be healthy and well.
I'm overwhelmed in trying to respond because there's so much in that response you just shared. For one, I want to move into your neighborhood. It just, I think if communities, if organizations, if workplaces, if all neighborhoods could be like that, what a world we would have. And you said the word possibility coming out of this. And I think that's kind of the flip side of the coin with challenges and constraints is there is that possibility that comes together. And so much that possibility, to your point, is opened up through connection, through human connection, which I think a lot of times when crisis sets in or we're feeling frantic or uncertain, we tend to close out connection is a response for a lot of people. We tend to turn inwards instead of turning outwards to community. And I'm curious to know, in the work that you do, where organizations, where leaders, where nonprofits you work with might be feeling that fear, how do you help them and support them to lean towards trusting in the possible and trusting in the possibility of connection and community?
That's such a great question. I mean, I think an important thing to acknowledge is that the tendency, as you described, Lisa, for us to experience fear or uncertainty and go inward rather than open ourselves outward to possibility, that is, I'm going to call that a trauma response. And I've been reading a book called My Grandmother's Hands. And this book is incredible. And it's written by a practitioner of somatic therapy. And it's written for people who identify as Black, people who identify as white, and people who are in law enforcement in the United States. And the book is about racial healing. And racial trauma. And one of the key insights that I have picked up from this book and other books that I've read about trauma and the trauma response in the body is that we learn because our brains are wired to protect us and to ensure our survival. We learn to form biases around certain stimuli, right? So certain people, certain ideas, even certain behaviors, our brains form these patterns that say, this is not going to help your survival, so you should turn yourself away from it. And for everyone, every person in this world is going to have a different set of patterns in their brain, a different set of biases. But I think what's really unique about people in the United States is that we have historically rooted and deeply, deeply held trauma that reflects the history of this country. And the history of this country, despite the dominant narratives in our collective memory, has not been about coming together. It has not been about responding to crisis by gelling with our community. The historical response for our culture, for this country, has been retreat, individualize, separate, protect yourself, survival of the fittest. And that's just, my theory is that that's just sort of baked into us. And just like every individual person who has their own individual experiences and traumas, everyone deserves healing. I think that our country deserves healing and needs sort of a collective healing in order to be willing to come together in a crisis. And quite frankly, we don't have a whole lot of practice with it. I mean, we've been relatively shielded from the daily traumas of war and genocide and all of the atrocities that many other parts of the world experience, at least in the modern era. So when things like COVID happen or, you know, other serious crises, we don't really have a lot of muscle memory about how to respond. So we respond with the trauma response, which is retreat, individual, survival of the fittest, right? So it's a pattern of, or it's a process of unlearning that, again, we have to, in order to achieve that, we have to make the big small. And so the way that I approach this is at the individual level and with teams. And I work on helping people understand how trauma forms certain patterns in the brain and how our responses are shaped by our experiences. And once we have that awareness, then we can begin to apply some techniques to learn how to see it and address it when it comes up. And some of those techniques are very simple. They're conscious breathing, meditation, noticing where you feel tension or anxiety or fear in the body as soon as it comes up and allowing yourself to process it, right? So that's like a very small action that sometimes requires a guide. So I'm happy to be that guide for individuals. And then also helping smaller systems like teams or small organizations or communities, tightly knit communities, networks, to understand how that trauma might be sort of baked into their system and instilling practices to help us collectively become aware of it and collectively commit to resolving it.
Yeah, like with Lisa, I'm just trying to process all of the goodness that you just shared with us, Catherine, and wisdom. To build on to something you mentioned how at the end of the day, and no big surprise to listeners, it all comes down to trust in a lot of ways. And I would like to kind of guide us more towards how you're thinking about trust specifically when you are doing this work, whether that's individual or with the, you know, small organizations or teams. How do you see trust manifesting itself in the work that you do?
Well, I think that trust is critical for the work that I do. It's critical that the people that I work with trust me and that they trust each other and also that they trust themselves. And trust is a sort of, you know, it's a kind of a complex thing because it's not something that can be easily gained, but it can be easily taken away and or disrupted in some way. And the things that might disrupt a sense of trust in an individual or in a group could be totally innocuous, right? It could be a comment that someone makes that, you know, maybe isn't well thought out, but doesn't have any ill intent. It could be an action that destabilizes another person's sense of, you know, who you are or what you care about. So I think it's really important that we understand in doing this work that it takes time, a lot of time, to build a strong foundation of trust, and that there is no, it's not a linear process. It's not a process where we start and we have no trust, and then we spend a certain defined amount of time with each other, and now we have trust, and that's it. Now we can move forward in trust. Only with the most intimate relationships do you have that kind of progression. In most relationships, it is cycles. It's different degrees of trust that are developed and cultivated over time. So, and I think it's important that we're talking about this because I've seen in movement work where an entire effort, like really powerful effort with a lot of potential, can be disrupted because trust is broken. And it's often at that point where people start to give up on the effort itself, which is really, really disheartening. And so another component of this that I want to reiterate and that I do reiterate with clients is that even if trust is broken or shaken or disrupted, if we are committed to the same vision, if we care about the same things, then we also must be committed to repairing what's broken. And so, again, that kind of goes back to the idea that trust is a product of time. It's also a product of proximity, right? There is a quote that says, social change moves at the speed of relationships and relationships move at the speed of trust. Well, my addendum to that is trust is all about proximity, closeness. We have to contact each other, right? In order to know each other well enough and to understand and empathize with each other well enough so that the openness to trust is there and so that that foundation can be firmed up. That's how I think about it.
I think there's a lot of alignment in our worldviews around trust. And I'm laughing a little bit with this. We've got our newsletter going out tomorrow. This podcast will air afterwards, but there's a short little article in there called The Trust Prediction. And it talks about that we can predict the trust level that you have with people based typically on just looking at one factor, which is the frequency of interactions. Mm-hmm. Just as you're saying, going back to that proximity piece. And I think it's something that people often take for granted or think like trust once and done and move on, and not looking at this, bringing it back to a plant analogy, like a plant, whether it's a seedling or a perennial that you've got to continuously nurture and grow over time and build those relationships out. I want to take a little bit of a left turn with this conversation, or maybe an inward turn on this one, is that I'd love to know with you, and you've talked about resiliency in community a little bit, but I'd love to know, looking at taking care of yourself in this work, where you're dealing with a lot of complexity, a lot of uncertainty, guiding people through unknown paths necessarily, and also a lot of long-term vision, long-term goals. How do you trust in yourself as you go about this work?
I rely on other people a lot to be my teachers, my mentors, my guides, my friends, people I trust enough to hold up the mirror and let me see where I need help, where I need to stop and try again, where I need to let things go. My community, my network of support is really an important component of that. And I think it's really critical to have people in your life who are willing to and who you trust enough to give you honest, consistent feedback. And so that's a big part of it. The other thing that I have learned about myself is I need, in order to tap into my own inner wisdom and to learn to trust myself and my own intuition, I need periods of time that are uncommitted. I need periods of time where I am not spending a lot of energy on others and where I can really have the space to go inward and hear myself. So I started this year in 2021, I started to schedule quarterly retreats for myself. And these are just usually 2 to 3 days each quarter where I don't schedule anything. And I usually plan to sleep in, exercise, or practice with my yoga teacher. I often spend these days writing or reading or just sleeping. And I have found those times to be really critical for me, really important. And I really value those times and I look forward to it. And I love knowing that they're coming every 3 months. Making space for listening to yourself and reminding yourself that you are one to be trusted is so important in this work. A lot of us in the movement space struggle with overexertion and burnout, and we fall into this sort of trap, this sense of urgency and constantness that we have to always be giving. And we can't do that if we haven't had the chance to recharge ourselves. And it's really a disservice to the movement for us to not rest and for us to not take time to tap into ourselves, because, you know, so much of what I value in my teachers and my mentors and my friends is their wisdom. And guess what? That's what they also value in me. And if I'm not able to tap into that and really hear that in myself, then I can't offer it to anyone. I'm taking an extra step on this idea of rest this winter, and I'll be taking 3 weeks. I'm calling it a sabbatical intentionally, even though most sabbaticals, like when you think about sabbatical, they're usually like, you know, a year or something, but I'm on purpose calling it a sabbatical because I like the root word of Sabbath, which is, you know, essentially translates to a day set aside for rest and reverence. And that's what I'm doing in this 3 week period. And I've already got the email scheduled to send to my clients and my partners and collaborators. Like, if you need anything from me, get it to me before December 15th. I will not be available afterwards. I will see you in the new year. And my intention for that time is simply to rest. And I don't have any other purpose beyond that.
I love the idea of a 3 week sabbatical, or just a quarterly sabbatical of 2 days, or whatever it is. I think sustainability is something that I always struggle with. And so always hearing other people really prioritizing it makes me want to get my own act together.
I support it, Rick. I support it.
Do it.
I will. Catherine, this has been super awesome. Just to kind of start wrapping this up, I would love to know, like, you have shared so much wisdom and insight into organizational design and human interaction and network effects, but I will be a little greedy and I'll ask you, are there any other quick pieces of practical advice that you would offer to anyone who is looking to strengthen their community or move a movement forward or bridge gaps with other people?
Sure. I mean, I think the advice that I would give in response to this question is the same advice that I would give in the response to most questions that, like, my clients or our partners or friends ask me, which is, there's really nothing more valuable in this life than understanding what you want from it, what you desire from it. And when you have clarity on that, the next steps become so much more clear. And again, it's one of those things that sounds simple on its face, but we're really not taught, especially women, we're really not taught to identify what we want. We're taught that it's seen as selfish or self-serving to have desires. And sure, sometimes, like anything, I mean, anything can be corrupted. So yes, of course, it could be. But like when I think about what I want a world for my daughter and for all the children that I love and for all the children in the world that allows them to be free and happy and healthy. Like, that's what I want. That is my deepest desire. And so knowing that that is what I want helps to guide my steps and helps me to make wise choices about what I do with my time, with my resources, and with my energy. And I can't think of any better use of this life than understanding what you're here for and what you want out of it, and then going after it consciously. So that's my advice.
I think your advice is an incredibly powerful place to bring this episode to a wrap. Catherine, I'd love to, and we know you have a sabbatical coming up mid-December. Do not contact you after December 15th.
You can contact me, but I won't respond until January 7th. Yep. Yeah, I have a lot of exciting things happening in 2022. I am really growing my practice around philanthropic transformation towards racial equity. And I have learned a lot this year in my practice and with my collaborators that I think is extremely valuable to the field of philanthropy. So I'm looking forward to sharing what I'm learning and offering my colleagues in philanthropy some really guided insights about how to move forward with their own racial equity goals. Most of my work right now can be found on my LinkedIn page. So you can just look me up on LinkedIn, Catherine Evans, and I will from time to time post articles or other resources on that page.
Amazing. We will definitely get all of your links into the show notes for listeners and readers to go and find out more. Thank you so much for joining us today, Catherine. This has been amazing.
It has been amazing. Thank you, Rick and Lisa. I appreciate you having me on.
Really appreciate this conversation, Catherine.
Thank you.
And that's a wrap for this episode of In Trust. Thanks for listening. Remember that trust is better together. So if you enjoyed this conversation, please share it with someone who you think might appreciate it and leave us a review. The In Trust podcast is produced by Spotlight Trust, where we help leaders and organizations put trust at the center of their work so they can achieve more than they ever thought possible while adapting to our fast-changing world. If you'd like to get in touch with us, simply email podcast@spotlighttrust.com.